Do you want to live forever? Immortality sounds like a nice idea in theory, but when you stop to think about it, an endless life could eventually become dull, repetitive, and meaningless. In fact, it's our very mortality that gives life its richness and beauty. That's the view Dean Rickles puts forward in his new book, Life is Short, an appropriately brief guide to making it more meaningful. Dean is a professor of history and the philosophy of physics at the University of Sydney, Australia, and the author of multiple books. He joins us now with five big ideas from his latest.
Hi, I'm Dean Rickles, a professor of history and philosophy of modern physics at the University of Sydney in Australia, where I'm also a director of the Centre for Time. And I'm also part of the Big Questions Institute and Big Questions Expeditions. I'd like to briefly discuss five key insights from my new book, Life is Short, an appropriately brief guide to making it more meaningful, published by Princeton University Press. It can be best summed up as a kind of modern reimagining of the Roman Stoic philosopher Lucius Annaeus Seneca's book On the Shortness of Life, which was also a very brief book, and an earlier example of a self-help book. Seneca's main point in his book was that life is not so much short as very badly wasted, which I agree with and expand on in many different ways using new ideas from philosophy and also physics and psychology that have emerged since his time, which was around the start of the first millennium. First insight, living forever, immortality, is not a good idea if you want a life of meaning. This is a major difference between Seneca's book and mine. While Seneca argued that it's not that we have a short time to live, but that we waste a lot of it, I argue that life's very shortness is in fact the primary source of its meaning. Life is short, and it is so for good reason. The German philosopher Martin Heidegger defended a similar view in his book Being and Time, which is undoubtedly a work of genius. But there's a rather friendlier version of this basic idea in the TV series The Good Place, where the good place is an eternal afterlife, in which, in the penultimate episode, the inhabitants are offered a way out of eternity and into nothingness, which many gladly accept because of the emptiness of existence without limits. But it's not so much the tedium of eternity that I'm concerned with. My book is very much about the need for limitations as a way of constraining our possibilities and choices. Death is the most important limitation of all because, and this is the main insight here, this finite boundary is required to enable the choosing of possibilities, making only some actual, along with the discarding or sacrificing of possibilities that we've left behind with our choices, which will never become actual. It's this feature that allows us to build meaning into our lives because we are, in this way, making ourselves as we wish to be. Life, through our choices, becomes a kind of construction project. Yet with no constraints, we never have to sacrifice anything. We never have to choose. We can sample all things eventually. And that boundlessness, while seemingly godlike and attractive, is ultimately empty. Insight number two. Going back to Seneca's idea of the wastage of time, we do indeed tend to be careless with our time, despite its very real brevity. The finiteness just mentioned means that it's a scarce resource for us, so it becomes irrational to misuse it, much as it's irrational to misuse other finite resources, such as the Earth's forests and waters. For this reason, I argue that it's very useful to think of this wastage as a disease of time, just as there are diseases of the body. The idea of wasting time implies that you possess a resource that's being used up now in a way that depletes without benefit, takes from more profitable usage that would lead you to flourishing. Related to this is the idea of discounting the future, so that the farther into the future something is, the less it matters to you, and this includes your own future self. A nice example of this temporal myopia can be found in an episode of Seinfeld from the Glasses episode, in which he speaks of the night guy. Night guy is the version of Seinfeld who likes to stay up late. leaving poor Morning Guy to wake up groggy and exhausted after 5 hours sleep. Night Guy always screws Morning Guy, and there's nothing Morning Guy can do about it. The only thing Morning Guy can do is to try and oversleep often enough so that Day Guy loses his job and Night Guy has no money to go out anymore. Of course, Morning Day and Night Guy are one and the same guy, but most of us tend to live as if we are split across time into different people in much the same way. This causes us to do damage to ourselves in the future, including not caring about the environment which our self in the future will occupy. Now, if this is a disease, there must surely exist a cure. And indeed there is. It's the ability to think of your future self as still very much you. It's a mistake to even think in terms of future and past selves, I argue. There's just you in the future and in the past. Anything damaging to yourself in the future is damaging you, not a distinct future self. By increasing the vividness with which one views yourself in the future and increasing the feeling of connectedness, you'll be less prone to temporal diseases. Just as you would be less likely to overindulge in alcohol if it gave you an instantaneous, non-deferred headache. If you learn how to think of yourself as a single thing existing at different times, viewing yourself in the future as much the same as yourself now, you will try, with practice, to avoid giving yourself in the future a hangover. Insight number 3. There are various ways to waste time. One is, as in the previous insight, by following frivolous or unworthy pursuits and damaging yourself now and in the future. But a far less obvious, though at least equally damaging way, is by not really engaging with anything at all, in a real sense, but merely existing rather than living. The psychoanalyst Carl Gustav Jung called this the provisional life. Seneca refers to the state as a tossing about rather than a journey, which forges a path through the space of possibilities. Life is not merely existing. It's not just being there for the lapse of time. It's often thought to be quite rational, though, to stay uncommitted to some particular possibility, be it a job, a relationship, or whatever. We have folk wisdom telling us not to put all of our eggs in one basket, for example. But with so many options open, what results is more like a dreamlike state than wakefulness and reality. We should rather aim for lucid waking, for being active in as many selections from the range of possibilities as we can, and for being as aware of the choices that present themselves to us as possible. The keeping open of one's options might seem smart, akin to a shrewd management of a financial portfolio, but it simply removes one from actuality, and you end up stagnating, living in what's essentially a primordial void. However, I again diverge from Seneca and from Jung in providing a slightly different picture of why we might adopt such a provisional stance. The provisional life can be understood in quite rational terms, but still something to be avoided because it's not, in fact, life. I argue that we shouldn't then be quite so dismissive of the avoidance of commitment. The world is full of possibilities. A world full of possibility is also full of uncertainties. And from this uncertainty comes the anxiety of having to face the risking of decisions. What is the ultimate source of this anxiety? Well, I suspect it's the latent knowledge that each decisive action taken is simultaneously a kind of death, as much a destructive act as a creative or productive one, killing off alternatives to allow just a single one to live. A commitment is thus a sacrificial offering of sorts of the other possibilities. The anxiety is the recognition that decisions can matter in a fundamental way, both for the decider and for the world around them. Hence, the solution, assumed to be rational here, is simply to not make any decisions and keep all options on the table. And of course, since our space of possibilities is ever shrinking as we age, we naturally want to retain as many options as possible, viewing them as the very spring of life. But, as we've seen, a life without limit can only produce a stagnant pond. Those that live as if unlimited are referred to in psychology as puer eterni, or eternal children. They try to stay unlimited, unbounded, and godlike, because to limit oneself means precisely to kill off possible futures. And so it's a momentous act to decide to do this. One must take responsibility for such active choices, hence the childlike nature of those who refuse to do so. But failing to take control of the process doesn't prevent the elimination and carving of possibilities for you. The only thing that changes is that others will decide on your future possibilities instead. And here, I'm put in mind of Terence McKenna's idea of radical freedom, according to which you should view it as your birthright to take control of your body, mind, and self. And if we ignore that this was told to Terence McKenna by a talking mushroom, which could happen to anyone, the following statement is a good one. You must have a plan. If you don't, you'll become part of somebody else's plan. Insight number 4. While we take away the godlike property of being unlimited or unbounded, we leave open the door to another godlike ability. This is the cosmic power of choice, of actualizing some possibility from the many available possibilities. Now, ordinarily we think of limitations, especially that ultimate limit of death, as things that disrupt our freedom, precisely because they remove possibilities in this way. But paradoxically, limit can be seen to give birth to freedom. And furthermore, this freedom born of limitation is where a bounty of meaning lies for all of us. Death is the most important limitation of all, because this is exactly what is behind the coherence of choosing possibilities. Death is our greatest gift in terms of meaningful existence, since it's the very source of choice, of having to decide, precisely due to its focusing on narrowing effect. Decision is you being in control of what happens. It's you happening to the world rather than it happening to you. You play a role in forging how things go and in picking who you are. This is real freedom. Such limits become most directly observed at moments of crisis. There are times when we feel that we stand in a fork in the road, or we feel on the edge of a cliff, and that feeling is fear, because we know at such moments that we are pruning some possibilities away in an irreversible fashion. The fear is rational, again, because it's a momentous thing. Often this comes at midlife, of course, because we know that we are also at a turning point in life, at best halfway to the end. At this point, decisions seem to take on a greater magnitude, precisely because our options are becoming more limited. Indeed, the very word crisis comes from the Greek word for deciding, krinein. Here, death, like a beam of light, focuses as it narrows, and it frees as it limits. Taken further, in committing to some course of action, you direct the universe as much as your own future. This is nothing short of demiurgic. It's cosmic freedom. I think most people instinctively realize this power to affect the world, and yet they cower and become small in the face of so great a responsibility. Instead, they transform into mere objects and let nature take its course with them instead. And indeed, nature will take its course with you if you let it, guiding your future with its ineluctable logic. Insight number 5, and this is a more general insight, which is that philosophy is relevant to life, more so than ever. We live in a world that seemingly wants to dehumanize us at every turn and turn us into mere objects or machines. The kind of deep, open-minded, truth-directed thought involved in philosophy can help you elevate your thoughts despite the lowering effects of the goings-on on this planet. Ultimately, you can elevate yourself so much that you will see ways to help improve things around you and eventually generate positive rather than negative feedback. Philosophy is the ultimate self-help tool. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the book if you decide, from your space of possibilities, to buy it. It's brief and so won't take too much precious life and possibility from you.
Thank you, Dean. That was Dean Rickles with 5 big ideas from Life is Short, an appropriately brief guide to making it more meaningful. To keep exploring a philosophical approach to happiness, check out our book bite for The Good Life Method, Reasoning Through the Big Questions of Happiness, Faith, and Meaning. I'm Michael Kovnat. Have a great day.